Hi, I'm Stephen Scott, and welcome to a special series of podcasts coming your way here on RNIB Connect Podcasts every week for the next 4 weeks. I'll be joined each week by Paul Ribb, a former banker who lost his sight later in life, and he is going to be sharing his story of dealing with his sight loss on a range of different topics. Let's start off by introducing Paul to you.
Thanks so much, Stephen. My name is Paul Ribb, and I'm a retired investment banker who became visually impaired back in 2007 at the age of 37 while I was employed in investment banking. So, I'm looking forward to having a chat today about the experiences that I came across that were obviously challenging, but also dynamic insofar as being able to maintain my level of employment.
I know you've got a lot to share with us and a lot of personal experience to share. And this is what I want to really dig into with you, Paul, because you have got a great story to tell. But I think it's an important story for other blind and partially sighted people to hear, especially in this world where being visually impaired does mean your chances of getting a job are much less. What has your experience been? And if we can maybe take you back to that day, that period in your life when you were losing your sight, what was those thoughts that were running through your mind about, in this case, employment?
Yes, the sad thing is when you become disabled, and sadly the majority of people do become disabled in terms of the disabled community or population. Just to say, Stephen, in the UK alone, I think 20% of the population is registered as disabled in some form. Mm. And the majority of those have become disabled, typically in middle to later life. And that was my experience. I was 37 and I literally woke up and couldn't see properly. So that really put me on a path of asking a whole myriad of questions. What do I do now? The charities and the support networks at the time, and even still to this day, point to the fact that you are on a slippery slope. You're going to struggle to either gain or maintain employment, and you may then require benefits and support and the like. I was keen to sort of focus on a more positive path and wanted to maintain my employment, wanted to maintain my independence, and I was convinced that I could do it. And technology is a great enabler, so I was sure that with the help of technology and maybe some kind advice, I'd make it. But there's one fact that I'm very grateful to a man called Dennis Lewis, who pointed me in the direction of something called group income protection or permanent health insurance, and this is a policy that is really a singular answer to the becoming disabled problem in later life, particularly if you are employed. But even if you're not employed and get employment, it covers pre-existing conditions. And we can talk about that because existing and pre-existing conditions for disability are interesting when it's about insurance and employment. And if I just backtrack on that a little bit, When you take out life insurance or critical illness cover, you do that in a personal capacity as an individual. People will be familiar with that. They may speak to an IFA or they may go direct to the various providers, and you can do that as an individual. When you're employed, it's an entirely different ballgame. Your company has a whole host of services that they'll offer to you through HR. That will be health insurance, life insurance, sort of gym membership, etc. All sorts of allowances and things that happen on your pay slip that you can tick and select as part of an employment. The most important policy that you should either ask for or demand, or the government should actually insist on because it actually alleviates a lot of the pressure off them, is that everybody should have group income protection. I was lucky because the banks I worked for had it, and I didn't know about it at the time. It was just on my payslip. I was contributing towards it. But what it means in simple terms is that if you become incapable of doing the job while you're employed, your employer is insured against you not being able to work for them. And more importantly, you as the individual are protected under insurance insofar as your salary will be paid to you up to a maximum of the age of 65. So as you can imagine, I was 37 at the time. I knew that I was becoming disabled and that there was a risk that I wouldn't be able to work for the length of my time. And I wondered how I was then going to be able to make money or contribute to my lifestyle, etc. Having that insurance policy in the background as I was coping with all the challenges of becoming disabled was probably the single most valuable tool in my armory. And that really set the scene and the tone for my attitude and my confidence thereforth, because knowing that you're relatively well protected financially at a time of real personal challenge is really invaluable, immeasurable.
And that's a great thing. And you're right. I mean, to have the availability of that is key. If you don't have access to it, of course, you are in that world of what do I do? I mean, like you say, so many people are in the position today where they are learning that they're losing their sight. I feel in some ways I'm in the minority because I've been visually impaired my whole life. Whereas, you know, a lot of the people I meet, people like yourself, you know, have experienced this later in life or through their life. And, you know, I think in that sense, the charity's message in some way, although it can feel negative, and I get that, I absolutely do. I'm very positive minded about this myself. And I think let's, you know, as much as we can, you know, gather together our strength and push on through. But the reality is, as I've experienced, I can have all the confidence in the world. I can be the most confident guy on the planet. But, you know, I'm a typical blind guy in the sense I've got a pair of sunglasses on and a white cane. And when I walk into that interview room and say, hi, I'm here for the job, they don't see me. They don't see my skills. They don't see my CV. They see sunglasses, white cane, problem. And that's the reality in life, isn't it? And that's, we need to change that.
We do. And, you know, again, highlighting or dispelling the myths of disability in employment is something that I'm really passionate about. We've seen so many encouraging statistics that demonstrate that a diverse workforce is a powerful thing for a company. And I would say that diversity to a large extent has been dominated by gender and BAME issues globally over the last few years, and they've made incredible strides, and to some extent disability has been left in the shadows. But you know, I was very encouraged in 2019 by an Accenture report that highlighted that you know, any company that does encourage and highlight and hire disabled people is a better productivity and cultural fit, and it should be encouraged. The problem was then COVID hit, and so a lot of that data has been lost. As we hit full employment, it really was the disabled market's turn to shine. But obviously now with COVID and the whole issue of furlough and unemployment, sadly, disability employment has once again been pushed a little bit to the side. But again, in terms of productivity, I've seen so many amazing statistics of companies that have benefited from hiring disabled people or from having disabled people in the workforce. They're more loyal, they're more productive, they are more resourceful. All of these things that are to the credit of the individual and what they bring to the companies. The problem you've always got is you've got to overcome the myths within HR and the managers who think that hiring disabled people will be a burden. And that is just simply the wrong attitude. To your point, though, Stephen, already having a disability or becoming disabled, the permanent health insurance or the group income protection insurance policy doesn't discriminate. This is the amazing difference between being an individual or having the power of a company or group scheme behind you. And to not get into the weeds of insurance rules and regulations. If you are an individual and you are hired by a company and that company has group income protection, which they should do, it's a group scheme, it means that the company premiums are very low, and everyone with a pre-existing condition, so if, even though you're blind already, you are still protected by that insurance scheme, such that in the event that you're not able to do the job over time because of your disability, you're insured against it. So you would still be able to retire with grace in the fact that the company is protected through group income protection, through your disability. So again, it's a very, very powerful policy.
Yeah, and it's like all these things, like, I mean, for example, Access to Work, which I'm sure you've heard about, the government scheme that enables someone who is disabled to get support in terms of technology and also an access to transport to and from work, and even within work as well, is classed by even the government itself as one of the government's best kept secrets. It's almost as if they come up with these things and they do not want to highlight them. Because if they highlight them, they'll become popular. And in some cases, I think if we're honest about it, there's a lot of disabled people who don't really want the spotlight shone on it either. Because it's good. It works. Don't tell anyone about it. If you do tell someone about it, suddenly it's going to become front page news on the Daily Mail, right? So, you know, that's the fear that we live in, that the good things we shouldn't talk about, which is ridiculous.
Well, you know, I mean, there's... If you combine Access to Work, which is a fabulous tool for employers and employees, obviously you have to be in work to utilize it, but that's the point. It alleviates the pressure from the employer. If you combine that with the knowledge of group income protection or permanent health insurance policy, it's a win-win for the government. It's a win for the disabled person who is obviously then encouraged and motivated to seek work. And to contribute to the economy, the purple economy, as it's so affectionately called within the disabled community, in terms of what disabled people can contribute. Very powerful contribution, the purple pound, the purple economy, as it's known. But you're absolutely right. The tools are there, but they are not well known. And this is my biggest frustration. It's a frustration because, as I started out at the beginning, the majority of people who are disabled become disabled. And if you don't know about the things that are there to support you at your hour of need, it is a very, very stressful and challenging time anyway.
Yeah.
Without knowing what is available, that renders you into crisis mode, depressed mode, etc. It creates problems that don't need to be there at a time that when you need the most help. And so all I'm saying really is that this group income protection scheme should be compulsory. Every company should have this group scheme, because that would mean that actually the government then is not on the hook. So if you then become disabled, you're not just subject to a world of benefits and depression and difficulty. The company that you're working for is able to then either rehire or support you in what you need, and everybody wins. And that's why I don't really understand why it's not adopted by everybody. I'm lucky in that the banks I worked for had it, even though I didn't know about it at the time, which is another story. What's amazing is that one of the banks I worked for went bust during the financial crisis. So I actually lost, at my time of need in 2008, I actually lost access to the group income protection scheme at the time that I needed it most, which was in 2008. And I then went out to get another job in 2009. And I was very, very conscious at that point of understanding that I needed to find a company that had group income protection in it. And I got offered two jobs at the time. And one, when I asked the question of HR, purely directly, I asked them. I didn't even declare that at that point I had a pre-existing condition. I did before I signed my contract, and they were fine with that, by the way, in terms of declaring disability. And that's also another topical point. At what point do you declare your disability when you're going for interviews? But I actually chose the bank, obviously, that had the group income protection scheme, joined in 2009, and I worked merrily and successfully, and was promoted and did very, very well for the bank for a couple of years. Before which my eyesight then deteriorated more markedly, and I ended up seeking out the group income protection scheme. But you know, it's just an example of where this scheme helps people who are either disabled or becoming disabled and don't know that they're going to need it. But when you need it, my God, it's the lifesaver that you get.
I want to talk to you about technology because it's a big area for me since I started learning about how the iPhone became accessible or was becoming accessible all those years ago. And realizing that there would be a world when I didn't have to buy the blind box to do whatever I needed to do, right? So I didn't have to have a special box adapted to or connected to my laptop in order for it to work. Technology was becoming more inclusive in that way, that you could, the technology itself was being more accessible and being made to be more accessible, which is really important. Interestingly, your notes to me here before we did this interview, I read that you had written, "Don't get fired for failing to do your job due to not declaring, since without not declaring without the appropriate technology and reasonable adjustments, you will fail." It's very interesting because you mentioned this earlier about declaring disability, declaring your blindness or whatever it might be, but also, the onus is on us, isn't it? It's on us as well to learn technology, to know the technology, in order for us to get close to succeeding.
Absolutely, Stephen. And that's a very, very important point. You mentioned access to work earlier. Now, access to work may or may not appoint an expert in accessible technology with your disability. Ultimately, the onus is on you really to find a way to use the tools that are available in the mainstream or in the accessibility market to do your job as well as you can. Ultimately, if you can't do your job, then your disability has rendered you incapable of doing or performing that task. And then we get into the discussions of that group income protection scheme. But you should have every opportunity to learn about how to do your job with the relevant equipment that's available. Now, to do that, you're not going to know the answers. So, yes, you might employ access to work and they may send you a qualified expert in that area. But equally, you're going to need to lean on what I affectionately call, obviously, peer support. Peer support is where somebody has already trodden that path. So in visual impairment, we've got a wonderful charity called Blind in Business. They have a host of people that will be able to help you understand what technology is out there and what you may benefit from using. Now, that may be mainstream products as well as accessible products. And that's the point, really, is that without talking to people or leaning on other people that know about this stuff, you're just not going to be able to really get the best out of yourself. And that's something that I learned the good and the bad way, and the bad way being that without asking you're going to struggle, and that there lies the conundrum, which is if you struggle and you can't do your job, then it's obviously only fair and reasonable that your manager is going to ask searching questions of you as to whether it's appropriate that you stay on in the role. So,
and that's an interesting point you bring up, isn't it? Because I've heard both sides of this argument from people who have had those conversations with their manager, and people and managers who need to have that conversation with their staff. And on both occasions, on both sides, there's trepidation about the conversation because the manager's concerned that bringing it up will make it look as if, well, I'm trying to get rid of this person because I don't see the value in them anymore. So that's one concern that the employee might have. That may not be the manager's intention. In some cases, it can be the manager's intention. Let's not lie about it. Let's get it on the table. It can happen.
No, absolutely.
Some people think, I know of a very close friend of mine who went through this very thing where she lost her job because her manager basically told her, look, I can't have you here anymore. You're no use to me. And actually, all that happened as far as he was concerned was she was now in a wheelchair. Which is ridiculous. But then on the other side of the coin, you have the employee who thinks immediately that they are being forced out. And I think we have to get away from the entitled idea that everyone should come to our aid and fix everything for us. We need to take some responsibility ourselves.
Exactly. And that is the point, taking the personal responsibility, helping the company, helping the manager understand that you are productive and that you can do the job. The onus is on you. There's no question about it that we have to fight twice as hard. And that's why my point about employers understanding that disabled people are resourceful, they're productive, and they are loyal if the company gives them a chance to prove that they can deliver. Obviously, if they can't deliver, the company is a business. It's not a charity necessarily. And even if it's a charity, it still needs you to be able to deliver in the role. So we have to be pragmatic. I'm not going to lie. Things were very tough, I would say, 10, 15 years ago. If you were disabled, you're out on your ear. You're no use to them necessarily. The technology might not have been there. Today, the world is very different. Technology is the great enabler, and it has cured a lot of the problems that disabled people would have struggled with. And it's now actually free at the point of use, thanks to some of the big technology companies embedding it at source. I remember, 5, 6, 7 years ago when I was working, it was tens of thousands of pounds of equipment that my company and Access to Work had to support to allow me to do the job that I was doing. Today, all of that costs a zero because a lot of the software and hardware is available, and it doesn't cost any more than the normal equipment. And we only need to look at the iPads and the iPhones and the desktop computers to see how the software has been embedded so helpfully under accessibility. In other countries, so in America, there are diversity laws now which lend themselves more to female representation than disability, but I can see a time where actually companies are certainly moving towards the idea of having to have female BAME and then even disabled representation within boards, within executive bodies, and within staff. Like I say, with 20% of the population in the UK being disabled, it's going to be very difficult, I think, going forwards for companies to avoid having disabled people on their employed staff base. So I'm very much about showing what's possible and encouraging employers towards the benefits of having disabled people on their staff, but also highlighting the fact, as we talked about at the very beginning, that you they are going to experience, sadly, some of their staff becoming disabled. That is, as I say, the majority of disability is becoming disabled in middle to later life. And therefore, some of us are going to see that, and the companies need to be prepared for that. The technology is there to support it, and the help is there to be asked for, and the insurance backup is also there. So I would say that actually, HR departments, particularly now, it is incumbent on them also to know about these opportunities, as much as it is the onus on the disabled person to obviously source and support themselves in obviously their career paths.
Now, just picking up on that point and kind of just expanding on that a little bit, I want to be clear here that, when we say that people need to take ownership and take that responsibility, there is the reality. We have to acknowledge the reality. I certainly wouldn't be able to sit here and say that with a straight face if I didn't go through the challenges I had. I have to acknowledge that, when I, in 2017, learned, I had to learn JAWS, the screen reader, on my PC for, the first time, really, because up until that point, I was managing with magnification. When I realized I had to make that leap very quickly, that was intense. Intense to the point that I wondered if I would be capable of continuing my job, because I didn't think it was possible. I initially felt that the technology was going to beat me on this because I just couldn't keep up. I couldn't keep up with the level of emails. I'd gone to a course, I think 3 months after I'd started using it. 3 months later, I had gone to a course and they were asking us to jump through this document and find this and find that. And I was just completely lost. And I said to someone at the time, I can't do this. And I honestly, at that point, wondered if it was worth continuing in the role. And that's, and I think my advice would be, or my story is essentially, not my advice, my story to people is, you will face that, but stick with it. And exactly as you said, get people around you. Peer support is key. Whether it's technology companies or charities or whoever it might be, try and expand your network. Here at RNIB, we have a fantastic Technology for Life team. Their job is to support people in all kinds of different ways, including in employment. There's people who just have difficulty with the basic tasks of life right up to the more complicated. you know, the support is there. So, you know, I don't want people to go away with the idea of, oh, he's just telling us all we're all entitled and we have to just get on with it. No, because that's not the case. I don't think that, and I know you don't think that. However, there's an element of we have to, at some point, take the reins on our own lives. And when we'll know the time, we'll know the moment, because we'll feel it. It's fight or flight, isn't it?
You know, there's the red and the blue pill from the Matrix. You get to to choose which path do you want to take. And it's really hard. It's you're going to really fight those inner demons. And there's many a problem of giving up and having to, you know, lose to the emotions and the challenges of disability. But what I'm saying is that technology and society has moved in a positive direction. The toolkits are there. I've been on the journey. I've seen the dark side and the demons that come for you when you're really at your lowest ebb. But I have also managed to overcome that. But I never did it alone. I did it with the help of peer support, of people that I had found in society, in the networks, through the charities, the RNIB, the Macular Society, Blind in Business. They all helped me. But ultimately, I understood that I wanted to succeed, and I was going to fight to do that. And I'm just grateful that the toolkits that exist in this country, we are incredibly lucky to have access to work. We're incredibly lucky to have the technology companies that have developed and pioneered these solutions. We're incredibly lucky that there is something that is a group income protection scheme that employers at negligible cost can take on board. And that is a backstop that can protect us. Going back to the original point of do you tell an employer or a prospective employer that you are disabled or physically challenged? That is a very, very difficult call. And the timing at which, given the competitive employment landscape, no one person can make. It's just a gut feel as to when and how you make that call. I made the call when I joined my bank in 2009. I knew that they had employed visually impaired people. I knew that sight and sound technology was on their procurement list, and I knew that access to work, therefore, would easily be able to help me get up and running very quickly when I started my employment. So once I'd been offered the job, I told HR about the support and the help that I would need as a result of being visually impaired. But during the interview process, they didn't know that I was visually impaired. Obviously, if you're in a wheelchair and you are carrying a white stick, there's no getting away from it. You're going to clearly tell them that you're disabled. But it's on you to tell them and convince them that you can do the job. You know, you are not entitled to that job at the end of the day. And all I'm saying is that the technology is there and the support and the insurance is there to give you the best chance of succeeding.
We're going to have further conversations, but I want to leave this conversation today with one question. And that is a premise that I've heard a few times thrown around. I don't know quite where I stand on it, and I'm intrigued to get your take. I've heard this a lot of times. We, as disabled people, we have to push twice as hard to go half the distance. What's your take on that?
It's funny. My girlfriend or women that I know would say exactly the same thing. You know, life is competitive and life is challenging. Disability in itself is a phenomenal issue to deal with, physically, mentally. I would say that, you know, coming at it from a mainstream perspective, you know, people watch the Paralympics. 2012 was a game changer for people understanding just how superhuman and amazing disabled people are and can be. All I would say in all of this is that we're capable. We're capable of delivering, and ultimately we have to dispel the myths. And we are more productive. We're more resourceful. I know and I've seen the successes that disabled people bring to an employed workforce. The culture, the knowledge, it's incredible. I had no idea about blindness or visual impairment until I woke up at the age of 37 and couldn't see properly. And up until that point, I had lived a joyous, carefree life. But the challenge and the people I met that helped me overcome those fears showed me that really anything's possible if you have a positive attitude, or you bring a positive attitude to your challenge. I would say never give up, and I would say that always ask for help.
Paul, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Stephen.
And coming up next time, we'll be talking with Paul about how peer support helped him after he lost his vision. That's coming up on the next edition of Rib Talks with me, Stephen Scott, and Paul Rib. Thanks for listening, and we'll both catch you next time.